Hello and welcome to the Wellfest podcast with me, Marty Guilfoyle, the brand new health, fitness and wellness podcast brought to you by Wellfest together with presenting partners KBC. KBC are supporting communities across Ireland, bringing you tips on health and well-being as part of their sustainability actions. Partnering with leaders in health and fitness such as Wellfest and the KBC Dublin Marathon, they are playing a part in creating positive experiences that can be enjoyed by all. You can log on to kbc.ie to find out more, because KBC wants you feeling well good for Wellfest. Fest 2020. Now, let's dive into this week's episode. So I'm delighted to have Orla Walsh in the studio today to talk about all things nutrition. Born in Dublin, Orla qualified as a dietitian from King's College London. Orla is extremely well qualified and great at setting us straight when it comes to the real facts in nutrition. Orla, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm really excited about this one because it seems to be like the topic these days is food, food, food. Everybody is so interested in what they're putting into their body. First of all, nutrition. Why? Why did you get involved?
Well, I actually, my background is science, so I specialise in physiology. Mm-hmm. And we were in third year of the 4-year course when we had people come in and talk about what you could do after physiology. And so all the healthcare professionals came in and there was one dietitian. And if I'm honest, I didn't even know it was a profession. I was like, come again, when she said dietitian. And from that 5-minute chat, and I wish I knew her name, from that 5-minute chat, I started on the path to become a dietitian. Mm-hmm. So I studied clinical nutrition in Roehampton University in London. That got me into King's College to study dietetics. And then I've done other things after that. So I did a postgrad in sports and exercise nutrition. So that led on to the exciting arena of the Olympic kind of level. So yeah. I was a performance nutritionist for Athletics Ireland. Not all of them, but some of them for Rio Olympics and some of the Paralympians as well. And then some of the Sport Ireland crew.
That's so insane. Yeah. There must be like an element of pressure with that, is there? Considering that you're responsible for like the biggest athletes in the world heading off.
Oh, listen, I'm just a support staff. Every arena of my life is an element of pressure, because even with clinic work, some people will come in and they're paying a lot of money. Uh-huh. And they want to feel better and they want solutions. So there's always a pressure.
So let's get into gut health. Okay. It seems to be one of the biggest topics at the moment. Why do you think everybody is paying so much attention to it these days?
Because it's just dawned on us that our body isn't actually our own. So we have trillions of human cells, but we have trillions of bacterial cells. Uh-huh. So I guess you could look at our body as this giant restaurant, because we're not just feeding us and our human cells, we're feeding all of them. When you think about it, the pressure is mighty, because we need to feed those microbiome in our gut in order for our health to be supported. Uh-huh. And I think it's really exciting area, because it's definitely an iceberg scenario. We can see a tiny bit of the information, but really most of it's uncovered yet. And what is uncovered and what continues to be uncovered is extremely exciting, because it actually appears that every system in the body is affected by that gut bacteria.
No way.
I think people are very familiar with just gut bacteria and maybe brain health and maybe mood. But put it this way, if you take a specific probiotic, you can affect how your kidneys work. So it's every system in the body.
Mm. So what can someone do for their own gut health? Like, how can they, take steps to improve it?
So there's loads of stuff, and I think what people need to peel it back and go for the basics, because I think people might go for the maybe trendy stuff first and start making their own kombucha.
Something
and kefir and
on their Instagram feed or yeah.
But that's wonderful, don't get me wrong. But I think people need to pare it back and go, okay, well, am I drinking enough water? So most of us need around 35 milliliters per kilogram per day. So that's kind of 2 liters-ish for a lot of women, 2.5 for men. But it depends how sweaty you are and all these sorts of things.
Yeah. So say the average day where there's not much exercise happening, you'd recommend for a guy 2.5 liters and for a girl 2.
In and around. So hydration is important. You can also kind of look at your hydration when you look at your wee. So if you want kind of pale coloured wee, and you want to wee regularly, and you want a good volume. So if you have this tiny little trickle, it's just not enough. So you have to drink more water.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, it's incredibly important that so many of us aren't getting enough water each day or enough fluid. The other thing is that the WHO, the World Health Organization, suggests that 1 in 10 of us are eating enough fibre, and 9 out of 10 of us aren't. In Ireland, we're looking at around 80% of us aren't eating enough fiber. So we need 25 to 35 grams of fiber each day.
Okay.
Fiber is a bit like the sweeping brush for the system. So it just keeps our bowels moving.
Mm-hmm.
But fiber is so important for health and reducing the risk of most of those scary conditions and diseases we don't want to develop. But the fiber is in part anyway, not the whole food for the bacteria, but it does feed our bacteria. And we want good, diverse bacteria in our guts and microbiome. So again, fiber is important for gut function.
Fiber, I'm delighted you mentioned it because that's where I was going to go next. Yeah. I would use my Fitness Pal regularly. And according to my Fitness Pal, I should be taking in 39 grams a day, which to me seems very high.
Yeah.
But what I'd love to know is there...
easy wins.
Or not even easy wins. Yeah, well, that too,
you
obviously.
Want a nice, I want the short, easy solution.
Is there such a thing as too much fiber? You know, because I look at friends of mine that are, say, vegan, and they'd be naturally eating more fiber based on the amount of veg they're eating and stuff. I've struggled to hit the 39 grams that I'm being told to eat. But then some days I go well over it, and I'm wondering, is that bad for me? Is that...
generally speaking, no. Your gut will tell you if you've had too much. You know, people would, for example, get diarrhea or pains in their tummy if they're having too much and too much regularly. But our gut can handle an awful lot. Because like you said, vegan diets tend to be extremely high in fiber, which is great because of the abundance of plants. But no, lots of cultures get more. So a Mediterranean style diet might provide around 50 grams of fiber each day naturally.
Okay.
So I suppose the easy wins, like you'll get 10 grams of fiber from maybe 2 or 3 tablespoons of linseed, tablespoons of chia seed.
10 grams?
Yeah,
oh,
they are super high in fiber. So they'll have maybe 2 or 3 times the amount of fiber than other seeds or nuts.
So in terms of a meal, that could be something you could add to like porridge or...
exactly, or a bit of yogurt or something.
Yeah.
Because I think people assume that all nuts and seeds are the same, but they are really high in fiber, so 2 or 3 times the fiber content of others. Then beans, peas and lentils, super high. Just say the classic baked beans, which most people enjoy eating. So a portion, so that 200 gram tin will give you around 10 grams of fiber.
So you're well on your way just with a tin of beans.
Foods that give you maybe 5 grams are a standard portion of porridge, other standard portions of nuts and seeds, so around 30 grams. You know, so pears are extremely high in fiber, so that's their superfood property probably, is their fiber content.
And what about apples?
Apples are good, but pears, berries and mango stand out in terms of high fiber.
Amazing. Okay, so there are loads of little ways to get more. The seeds thing to me, that's blown my mind. I'm already on my way to get some of that since my porridge tomorrow.
Yeah, you'll easily meet that 39 grams.
Well, I'm already, like, I'm sometimes I do it, sometimes I go way over it. I can feel it in my body the days that I've gone over it, you know yourself. So yeah.
Enough said.
Enough said. I'm not going to go more into that.
Too much toilet talk. It's not a good thing for a podcast.
Never, no. Before we touch on probiotics, I actually want to talk a bit about an article that I read about fads and diet fads.
Yeah,
and stuff. And it was 10 fads that you were saying basically we should try ignore at the start of the year. And it interests me because a lot of them I tried and then given up. But there's one that I still do. One that stood out for me that I'd never heard of people doing before was putting butter in their coffee. I didn't realize that was a thing, that people were doing that.
Oh, haven't you? You see, most of the fads I try simply because I want to understand why people want to do it.
Okay.
So even with fads, no matter how silly they are, they're usually doing something and giving people something. So I try to understand the pros of them. And then scientifically, I like to understand the cons as well as the pros. And, you know, physically, I want to figure out what are the cons.
Mm-hmm.
So the butter in the coffee.
I could not. When I read that, I thought people were doing that, looking for a benefit. I was just so shocked. So
I know. But Irish people are very proud of our butter. We produce good butter here. So,
so we add it to everything.
Absolutely everything.
I actually only spoke about adding it to a digestive biscuit there last week on Twitter.
So good.
So good. It divided people. I was so shocked at how it divided people.
And what got me through breastfeeding was any biscuit, sorry, with butter on and cheese. I was addicted.
Butter and cheese.
I 100% know where you're coming from. Yeah, butter and cheese on my digestive.
Oh my God, wow. Another one there that I do to this day, and this is why this is one of the main questions I'm really excited to ask you, is you speak about, you know, eating the vegetables, not drinking them.
Yeah.
Now, I am a sucker for a smoothie. To me, it's a convenient way of getting it into me.
Yep, they're also delicious.
They're all, okay, fair enough. We'll go, they are yum. So obviously I'm not going to say no to one. And when it comes to meal prep and stuff, while I do it in my head, if I could, you know, get a smoothie instead of cooking the vegetables and adding them to my dinner, I'd rather drink them. So why is eating vegetables better for you than drinking them? What do you miss when you're drinking them instead of eating them?
Well, it's a great question. I suppose you first must look at whether you're juicing them, which is different than smoothie.
Okay.
So juice, you're kind of just taking the water really out of the flavoured water out of the vegetables and some of the nutrients, but not much. Smoothie, you're getting all of the nutrition because it's in that smoothie.
Okay.
When we think about it, what I'd like you to visualise is fruit in a bowl with yogurt on it. How long would it take you to eat that? Much, much longer than if you drank it. And what you need to think about is, okay, what does our mouth do and what does our stomach and intestines do? So they mechanically break down food and they chemically break down food. Mm-hmm. So we mechanically break it down with our teeth into tiny little pieces. Our stomach, it does that as well. And why our mouth and our stomach do that is because when it's broken down into tiny pieces, it can be chemically digested and brought into the bloodstream. Now, if the mechanical breakdown is already done for you by the blender, the chemical digestion can happen straight away. So you actually digest that meal super quickly and hits your bloodstream much, much faster. So that can play havoc with energy levels.
Uh-huh.
But it also is, you know, we can consume too much of it when we're not careful, but it does take away the mechanical breakdown for you. And it's important to eat our food because a lot of digestion happens when we're munching. Our digestive system often prefers when we eat it because it triggers the start of the digestion. Our bloodstream, you do want that energy hitting the bloodstream too fast for your energy levels. And when we eat things, it tends to be more filling and keep us fuller for longer because it takes up more space in your stomach and your body has to mechanically break it down before chemically breaking it down. So, you know, it does keep you fuller for longer when you eat it rather than drink it. The other thing to consider is that when we break it down, sometimes we do release the sugar from the cells and it becomes a different sort of sugar. It becomes a free sugar rather than a sugar within the cells of the fruit. And the scientific is intrinsic versus extrinsic, but what it means is that research suggests that free sugars are negative for our health, while sugars naturally found in food don't have the same implications. From a dentist's point of view, though, it will, when those free sugars are worse for our teeth as well. So I think dentists, more so than dietitians, are definitely not a fan of juices and smoothies.
Yeah, I can see why. It's so interesting because, like I said, when it comes, I'm a sucker for convenience order. I really am.
Which the thing is, you obviously do a lot of exercise. So, you know, for you to fit all the nutrition in a day, smoothies can be helpful.
Okay, I get you.
And because you're eating regularly, you know, your next meal is always around the corner. For the rest of us eating three meals a day, if we have a smoothie rather than eat that bowl of fruit with yogurt, we'll only be full for an hour to rather than full up for lunch. So it's different for you versus just say me.
Yeah. And that probably comes into an element with protein, by being a vegetarian, stuff that I'll talk about a bit more later when, you know, shakes versus actual plant-based sources of protein. But I'd love to touch on probiotics with you, and because they're very popular at the moment, and I'd love to know what ones we should be paying attention to, or even, like, is it important to take them all the time? You know, when should somebody take a probiotic? Should we be taking them every day? You know,
well, when it comes to probiotics, a lot of the supplements out there are just extremely expensive poo.
I've been there with supplements, especially when I was a teenager, spending money on something based on a picture on the bottle. And I've been there. So I totally get where you're coming from.
The thing is, a lot of the probiotics haven't been scientifically proven to make it past your stomach acid and actually make it to the colon where it's going to have most of its effect.
Okay.
So if you're buying something that hasn't been proven to actually make it to the place you wanted to make it, is a complete waste of money. Then a lot of them haven't been scientifically proven to get to your gut and do something positive. With each probiotic, you take a specific grain for a specific thing. It's a bit like antibiotics. You don't go to the GP and they go, oh, willy-nilly, just take this one. They actually put some thought into it and say, okay, antibiotics for this type of infection. When it comes to probiotics, you take a specific strain for a specific reason.
Okay.
Now, it gets more complicated when you look into it and the supplements arena on gut health, because there's probiotics, which tend to be the live bacteria that has been shown to do something. Prebiotics, which is their food. So it's the food for the bacteria in our gut, and it's it's usually only a prebiotic if it's been shown in clinical trials to actually do something in the gut and feed the bacteria. Mm-hmm. So we've got prebiotics, probiotics, then symbiotics, which are the probiotics and prebiotics together. We've got psychobiotics, which is basically the probiotics that have an effect on our mental health. And then we have these things called postbiotics, basically, which when the bacteria eat food, they release stuff. And the postbiotics is the stuff they release. And it's in some ways, you could describe it as cutting out the middleman, going, mm-hmm. okay, well, if the stuff they're released is the stuff we're after, why not just take that stuff?
Yeah.
But the problem is that most probiotics or all of these supplements that I'm talking about haven't been scientifically tested. And when the brand itself hasn't been tested, it's more often than not expensive poo.
That's crazy, which means we're essentially putting things into our body that... We don't really know why we're doing it, which is mad.
Oh yeah, but we do that all the time.
I know we do that all
with
the time.
With all supplements, yeah. But the probiotic one, yeah, hands down has to be the big money waster.
Yeah, so interesting. A good friend of mine, he's very open on his radio show actually about having IBS. So yeah. I know he's going to be locked in, ready for this question. You know, ways to like ease the symptoms. And another one actually, because I know even based on his work schedule, like would the stress... Does that play like a factor on it? Or
yeah, stress definitely does. So firstly, it's stressful to have IBS, and then IBS is exacerbated by stress. Mm-hmm. So it's a chicken and egg, and the chicken and egg both come first. So when it comes to IBS, if you think about it, if you've ever done a 10K race or uh-huh. gone to exam hall, there's a queue for the loose. Everyone's tummy is affected by stress.
Yeah, yeah.
So even if your IBS isn't 100% caused by stress, it's definitely exacerbated by it. So stress relieving practices are really important for gut. So we know that there's two studies, but 10 to 15 minutes of mindfulness each day, even like using an app, for anywhere between 8 to 12 weeks has been shown to have a positive impact on our gut. So absolutely stress
is
important.
It's not something that would spring to mind quickly, would it, really? If you think
no.
about it?
Yeah. Yeah, and stressful people will immediately go, I don't have 10 to 15 minutes.
I don't have 10 minutes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So with regards to food, we've talked about the water and we've talked about the fiber, but the breakdown of the fiber is important. So we have different sort of fiber. So IBS is a myriad of conditions. It can be for some people bloating and diarrhea. Okay. Others it's bloating and constipation, and there's other symptoms there. But just say you do poo that's hard, it's dry, mm-hmm. right? That can be a sign that you're not getting enough water, and it can also be a sign that that hard, dry poo, that you're not getting enough soluble fiber. So soluble fiber is a gel-like fiber, and its job is to soften the stool.
Okay.
So that makes it easier to pass. The other thing
and is that based on the food sources that you're getting it
yeah,
from?
Yeah, okay. Exactly. And a lot of the medications people take for constipation in particular are, as well as diarrhea though, are really just mimicking foods.
Okay.
So chia seed. Do you know when you put chia seed into water, it looks like frog spawn?
Okay.
Not to put you off chia seed, it's great for you. But that gel it releases, that's the soluble fiber, and that's the type of fiber that will soften the stool and make it easier to pass.
Okay.
The other thing is linseeds have been shown to be really effective. They soak up the water and push that stool through, usually without causing any sort of discomfort. Then some foods actually, they have what's called osmotic potential, meaning that they draw water into the gut and kind of, it's like flushing a toilet through your system, and keep that bowel moving. So the likes, lactose, so milk and mm-hmm. yogurt can be very good in constipation. Honey, because it's pure fructose that draws water
honey,
into
wow,
the gut.
Okay.
But other fruits that are high in fructose, such as mango. So again, it depends what the issue is. With regards to diarrhea, it can sometimes be too much fiber. It can sometimes be someone going, I want to eat better, and then all of a sudden doubling their fiber intake in a day, which upsets the tummy. It likes you to increase it slowly. But diarrhea can also be an intolerance to certain fermentable carbohydrates. Mm-hmm. And that's usually a dietitian-led exclusion diet. So you pull out the fermentable carbohydrates for maybe 4 to 6 weeks. And again, the dietitian would talk you through bringing them back in to find out what you're intolerant to, but more importantly, how much can you have before you're symptomatic, mm-hmm. which really helps manage diarrhea and bloating in particular.
And say when it comes to the final question of fiber, say there's a lot of, I can't really call them supplements because they are kind of like foods like that were high in fiber, but they wouldn't essentially be what you would call healthy foods in inverted commas. You know, you can get like biscuits and stuff that are like are higher in fiber than other biscuits. Like, would you advise them as well? Like, is that a good way to go about it, to add in that extra 5 to 10 grams, or are you always going to suggest fruit, seeds?
Well, I'd probably always go for the whole food.
Yeah.
At the same time, I think we're, I think we have this.
Again, it's more of like, hey, I'm a sucker for convenience here.
I know, but just because it's processed doesn't mean it's bad for you.
Okay.
Yeah, so you can get, for example, breakfast cereals that are high in fiber, yeah, low in sugar, and even have some vitamins and minerals
added. I love my bran flakes. I really, really do. Like,
you know, all bran has around 2 to 3 times the fiber content.
Yeah, and the thing about all bran is that it's just a taste thing again. You know, yeah, I much prefer the taste of bran flakes.
Yeah, but other makes, like Weetabix, Oat-O-Bix, okay, Muesli's, porridge. You know, there's lots of cereals out there that have greater than 6 grams of fiber per 100 grams and less than 5 grams of sugar per 100 grams. You just have to look at the back of the pack.
Yeah.
Now with a muesli, if they say no added sugar, there's usually no added sugar. But you will see that the sugar content might be slightly higher because of the dried fruit in it. That's okay. Okay. It's the sugar added that we need to be careful of. So those numbers again would be greater than 6 grams of fiber per 100 grams and less than 5 grams of sugar per 100 grams. And although we mentioned brands, you know, every supermarket has their own version of those.
Course, yeah.
So they're usually all very similar and a great choice.
Interesting. So I can keep eating my bran flakes and maybe have the eyeball of all bran instead. celiac disease is something you mentioned quite regularly. What are the implications of this condition and why could it go undiagnosed?
Yeah, so I feel like I'm always harping on about celiac disease on my Instagram page.
I was just going to say in your question and answers, yeah.
Yeah, so the reason is because 1% of the population have celiac disease and a lot of people are undiagnosed because I think people assume, oh, if I had celiac disease, I'd know about it. So a lot of people are shocked to say, actually, you might not have any symptoms at all, or you might have symptoms and not realize their symptoms. So for example, to explain celiac disease, it's an autoimmune disease where your immune system targets your small bowel when you're eating gluten. What it does is it reduces the surface area for absorption in your small bowel. Mm-hmm. So instead of having a surface area to absorb nutrients the size of a rugby pitch, it's now the size of a tube. So really decreases your absorption of key nutrients, and you might find that you're constantly suffering from iron deficiency anemia, mm-hmm, or B12 or folic acid, or you might have signs of osteoporosis or osteopenia even though you eat loads of dairy.
Okay.
Or, you know, there's lots of things. One of the ones that it's important as well is that if someone has unexplained fertility challenges, that could be another sign of undiagnosed celiac disease.
Oh wow, okay.
So there's real consequences to it. I suppose the most scary of all has to be
is that male and female?
Male and female.
Okay.
The other thing is that undiagnosed celiac disease can increase the risk of certain cancers in the small bowel. And that's the more serious side of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of those ones that, because it's so easy, you go to your GP, you get a blood test, and that usually gives a guide on whether or not you have to go for further tests. It will be the GP's kind of opinion on what to do next. But it's simple enough. The main thing to note, though, if you are going to the GP to get a blood test for celiac disease, it's really important to be eating gluten at the time. So you have to be eating wheat, barley and rye, which are the gluten containing grains. To put it in how much terms, which people like actual numbers, you're talking about wheat twice a day. So it might be pasta at dinner and a sandwich at lunch. But you want the wheat, barley and rye twice a day for the 6 weeks before the test. So that's it. So that it
every
is
day
actual
for 6 weeks up
accurate
until the test. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, some people listening right now, if you're telling them to eat more pasta, that doesn't sound like a bad idea.
Yeah, I'm in.
Yeah.
Do you know, in Ireland, new research came out just today that showed our second most popular dinner in the evening time is pasta with a sauce on it.
No way.
And what children's top meal in the evening time is pasta with sauce on it.
Really?
Yeah.
I would never have guessed that.
Oh,
no way.
Yeah.
Considering that you hear, especially when people go on these mad diets, that they try to avoid pasta, which to me is mad. I'm not going to get into that, but
yeah,
to think that it's one of the most popular meals, it's crazy.
What's interesting about pasta is that it's what we call a low glycemic load meal, our food. So it goes into the tummy and the carbohydrate it releases, it's really slowly into the bloodstream rather than fast into the bloodstream. So it's a low GI food. So, you know, it's actually eating in low glycemic load meals is a really good thing to do for weight loss. So one study looked at adding pasta into people's meals during weight loss and to see if it hindered or helped, and it was shown to help.
Yeah, well, I definitely believe it. And once again, if we're encouraging people to eat more pasta, they're going to be buying pasta straight after.
They're like, I'm in.
It's pasta like, and chia seeds. I was told in the podcast to eat more pasta, so I'm going to do it. We briefly touched, actually, this is something now, like, I cannot wait to hear your opinion on sugar. We touched on it really, really quickly there when you were talking about dried fruit in the likes of muesli and stuff. It has a bad rep. I feel like it had a bad rep. I feel like that went away, and I feel like it's starting to kind of come back now. Is it bad for us? You know, like I eat so much fruit. I love fruit. I really, really do. But they say that, you know, high sugar has a direct relation to weight gain. And that's why I feel like people kind of tend to avoid it for a weight loss purpose. Give us the lowdown on sugar and what types of sugars are okay and what aren't.
So first to start, everything's been demonized. Do you remember it was high carb, low fat diets and everyone had to follow it? Then it was low carb, high protein. And then it was low carb, low protein, high fat.
Yeah.
And then it was if you eat any animal protein, you're going to combust. But sugar... Sugar definitely was victimized at one stage, and less so now. To understand it, sugar naturally found in fruit and dairy is not the sugar that dietitians are trying to get you to eat less of. Okay. What they're trying to get you to eat less of is the free sugars. So that comes from the fruit juice that I was talking about, but also from the likes of jam and honey and sweets and cakes and all of that. It's basically sugar added to things. Mm-hmm. So it's not that it's toxic. It's not that if you have a little bit, it's going to, you know, awful things are going to happen or your health is going to deteriorate fast. In fact, you know, what we recommend is less than 6 teaspoons a day or less than 12 teaspoons a day, depending on which guidelines you go by. Okay. So it's not no sugar. It's just lower sugar.
In grams purposes, what are we looking at?
Sorry, in grams. So a teaspoon's around 4 grams.
Okay.
So it's somewhere between just say 25 to 50 grams or less each day of added sugar.
Oh, great. Okay.
So there is a bit of leeway there. With regards to fruit, I think fruit was victimized during that
big time. And that really upset me. Like,
and so it should, because fruit is so good for you. It's nature's candy. It's really good for us. It reduces our risk of a whole host of conditions and diseases, even reduces our risk of dying from anything at any one time. And it is a cumulative effect. But fruit is really good for us. In fact, when we look at studies for fertility, one came out and said people who had a higher fruit intake actually had better chances of conceiving. Okay. When we looked at fruit and gut bacteria, again, it's really important for the gut microbiome. And even when we looked at fruit and mood, we saw that when people increase their fruit intake, they're, you know, it correlates to a less risk of depression. So fruit and veg are absolutely excellent for you. Mm-hmm. So I would say to people, don't fear sugar. Our body will reflect what we continuously do. So if you have the odd chocolate bar, it's not a big deal.
Of course, yeah.
It's what you do most of the time that counts.
Just one last thing on sugar. I've noticed an increase in the last 2 or 3 years on the no sugar products. It's gotten to the stage where I was in a supermarket the other day, and for the first time ever I saw no sugar sauces. Now I've seen beans, like no added sugar beans and stuff, but there's now actually a chain of sauces where you're looking at, I think there's like 20 calories per 100 mils. It's something really low, and there's no sugar in them, yet they taste the same. So like, is there a point in making that substitution? Like, I love my sauces. I'm sure a lot of people who are listening do love their sauces. Which would effectively be better for you? I know people kind of talk about like the Diet Coke and the Coke thing. They're like, sometimes, well, the sugar one is probably better for you. I mean, you hear so many different opinions on it. What's your opinion on it?
So usually when they take sugar out of something, they have to add something in to make it tasty.
Exactly, yeah.
And so what are they adding in?
Yeah. That's the bit that scares me, you know. I'm like, what else? Why does this taste so good, yet it's, in inverted commas, not affecting me aesthetically, you know, that kind of way? So.
Well, I think, there's a difference between aesthetics and health, as you know
100%,
yourself.
100%,
yeah. But when it comes to food, I think people just need to pare it back and eat foods of one ingredient, whole foods most of the time.
Yeah.
Don't fear any food. Don't fear sugar. If there's a little bit, ask any chef, if they're making something with a tomato base, they do add in a pinch of sugar to balance out the acidity within that product. So sometimes you need sugar for it to taste nice, and a little bit isn't something you should fear. Like I said, you know, the guidelines is eat less than 12 teaspoons of sugar a day of added sugars. So that doesn't include fruit and yogurt, or less than 6 teaspoons if you're really being tightly controlled on it. So you can have a little bit to make your food taste nicer.
Yeah, I think a lot of people listening, the dairy one to me is something that I would have thought, yeah, natural sugars and fruit, but I would never have included dairy in that, which is great to know. So you're basically saying, look, if you haven't eaten your daily intake of added sugar, don't be restricting yourself to the no sugar sauces, you know, get the real stuff and just throw it on, basically. Live your life. It kind of brings us into the whole intuitive eating movement.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I love sport, I love training, and I've tracked before, I tracked the odd time. I'm not as strict on it now as I used to be, but a lot of people are. But then a lot of people now are, you know, they're advising us to just eat when your body tells you to eat, you know. What do you make of the intuitive eating movement?
Intuitive eating movement, I think there's a lot of confusion around it. Mm-hmm. But one of the takeaways that I'd like people to think about, it's really about how does that food make you feel.
Okay.
So it's a really individual approach and an individual experience with food, because it's kind of saying, listen, there's no judgment. If you know, if that tastes nice to you, it tastes nice.
Yeah.
Food has, it's more than just fuel. Anytime that it becomes just fuel, foods become boring, it's lost most of its meaning. So when intuitive eating, it's listening to your body, listening to how it responds to food, considering all of your senses when you're eating food. It ties in nicely with the mindful eating, eating without distractions. Again, a study came out today that 7 in 10 meals, evening meals, are eaten with a device now.
Oh, wow.
So 7 in 10 evening meals. So you're talking about,
well,
people have their
phones,
TVs, screens. But instead of going, okay, well, actually, I'm going to eat without distraction and think about my food. And, you know, think about the journey it's taken to get to your plate. So intuitive eating is a wonderful movement if it's used responsibly. Mm-hmm. Is it going to work for everyone? No, but one size doesn't fit all.
Mm-hmm.
But there's definitely parts of it that can be used in everyone's dietary patterns.
Mm-hmm. I'm vegetarian. I have been for nearly 4 years. I nearly go as far as saying I'm 90% plant-based. I did a stint of 3 or 4 months where I was 100% plant-based. And, you know, I get a lot of questions regarding, you know, hitting my nutritional targets while not eating meat.
Yeah.
For people who kind of want to go more, you know, plant-based, you know, what would you say to them? Like, what advice would you give them?
Well, firstly, there's lots of different names for things. It's weird. I think the generation coming behind us are kind of going, God, why do you insist on labeling everything?
I get
because there's lacto-vegetarians, there's ovo-vegetarians, there's lacto-ovo-vegetarians, there's pescatarians.
Pescatarians, yeah.
All of these different vegetarians.
I've had that argument many times with people.
Well, yeah. So exclusively plant-based can be, it is, it's different to vegan. Like if someone's a vegan, it's not just their food, it's everything. It's their cosmetics.
I found that out the hard way, yeah.
It's the clothes they wear.
Yeah.
It's absolutely everything. So it just depends on how many foods you're avoiding.
Mm-hmm.
So just say you still eat fish, you still eat dairy, you still eat eggs, then you probably have a nutritionally balanced diet and you probably don't need supplements beyond what everyone needs. Maybe a vitamin D, especially in winter, and folic acid if you're a woman of childbearing age. However, if you cut out are avoiding certain foods, you do need to think of, well, what nutritional gaps need to be placed. So if you're exclusively plant-based, so not eating any animal produce, you do need to supplement with vitamin B12. The research is really quite clear on that, because it's found in animal sources. Mm-hmm. It's not found in vegetarian sources.
And what if you're vegetarian, so you're not eating meat, but you do have the odd bit of dairy? Would you suggest supplementing on B12 as well then?
No, so a pint of milk will give you their vitamin B12
for the day. Oh, great.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you're still eating dairy, then your B12 is covered.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not eating fish, you're not getting the omega-3s found in oily fish.
Yeah.
So those type of omega-3s, EPA and DHA, are not the same as the omega-3s found in plants. So the omega-3 found in plants is ALA.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's found in walnuts and flaxseed and rapeseed oil. And that's brilliant for us, but it's different.
Mm-hmm.
So it's chemically different, so it acts chemically different in the body. So if you're not eating oily fish, you can take an omega-3 supplement, so EPA and DHA. So usually around 450 milligrams provides you with the amount of omega-3 that you would eat if you ate oily fish once or twice a week. Mm-hmm. You can, if you're a vegan as opposed to exclusively plant-based, you might choose an omega-3 phone from algae just because it will suit your views a bit better.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it is from algae, not from the oily fish. Mm-hmm. The other thing is if you're not eating dairy and you're not eating fish, you might struggle to meet your iodine intake. So most of us get our iodine from dairy and fish.
Okay.
Now, in studies, in one study in particular, 50% of women who are pregnant weren't taking in enough iodine. So that is worrisome because iodine is needed for thyroid function. Mm-hmm. And even when you're pregnant, it's needed for cognitive development, so brain development of the baby. Mm-hmm. And actually runs a risk of lower IQ and all these sorts of things down the line. So now you can get iodine from plants, so you can get iodine from seaweed. But how many people eat seaweed?
Oh, stop. I shivered when you just said that.
Like, oh, really? I love seaweed. It's really nice.
No.
And in Ireland, we produce it really well.
Oh, stop. I'm literally shivering over here.
Okay. So you just need to be more mindful of your iodine intake if you're not having dairy.
If I'm not. Yeah. Okay. Very interesting. I love it. So then you briefly touched on supplements there, and I feel like, especially when it comes to getting active, I feel like that's the first thing we do is we stock up on supplements, you know? Like, what is your take on supplements? Like, and what ones do you think we actually need? Or more importantly, when do we need them? Say, you know, we're told that if you weigh this amount, you need to be eating this much protein. What is your take on all this?
Well, if probiotics make expensive poo, a lot of the supplements produce expensive wee. A lot of the time, people are taking supplements that they don't need.
Yeah.
So the ones that we need, if you're eating all the foods on the planet, so you're not purposely excluding foods for any sorts of reasons like allergies and stuff like that, you probably just need to take a vitamin D supplement. Mm-hmm. And if you're a woman of childbearing age, you definitely have to be taking folic acid supplement. And if you get pregnant, you take it for the whole time you're pregnant. However, when we look at the supplements, you see, supplements do have uses other than fitting in nutritional gaps. So for example, you can use certain supplements for medicinal reasons, meaning you take a higher dose than's normally found in food in order to have a medicinal or a medical benefit. Mm-hmm. So this can be in maybe treating iron deficiency anemia, just say. It might be in helping support bone function. It might be in helping control PCOS symptoms, which 10% of women have. So supplements can be used for medicinal reasons as well. So again, they're not all bad. Most of us should be taking them if most of us have to take vitamin D. Mm-hmm. In sports, you can use supplements for sports performance benefits. So most athletes need to be taking vitamin C to reduce the risk of colds. Mm-hmm. So that's not the same for the general public, but it is for athletes.
Even if you're eating, say, you know, fruit?
Yeah, so they have to take a higher dose.
Okay, cool.
They're just more at risk because their immune system sometimes isn't being fed enough, but really it's just because of all the stress that's going on in their body from all that training. Then athletes might need to take, and regular folk might need to take other supplements. So just take whey, which is probably one of the most sold supplements in the world now. Whey is a protein naturally found in dairy. Mm-hmm. So if you were to take milk and you looked at the proteins in milk, 20% of that protein would be whey, 80% would be casein.
Okay.
So whey has been taken out of dairy and used. Actually, what's interesting is they used to take the casein out and make cheese with it, and the whey used to go into animal feeds. But now they realize whey is so important, so now they're putting into powder and selling
it. Out of this. Yeah.
And they are. It's $1 billion industry.
Mad. So it was literally considered like a waste. We don't need this. Yeah.
Sure. Little Miss Muffet sat on her top of it eating curds and whey.
Oh,
so whey.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So whey is so really high in branched chain amino acids, really high in leucine. So leucine is needed to trigger our muscles to grow and repair at their fastest rate. Mm-hmm. Our threshold for leucine, so how much leucine we need to get the benefit from a muscular point of view, depends on our age. So the older you are, the more you need, and our how much we train. So the less you train, the more you need. Now, that's why whey is really important as you get older. Mm-hmm. So actually, although whey is used in gyms all around the country, I wish it was used in nursing homes all around the country.
Oh, okay.
Another great example is creatine. So creatine, although it gets bad press, research suggests it's safe, especially it's batch tested creatine. So if any athletes are listening, look on informsport.com. But creatine is really for muscle fatigue. Okay. So fatigue resistance. And it has some other benefits as well. But again, although that's found in gyms all around the country, muscle fatigue, because of that benefit and because creatine helps with memory and cognitive function, it really should be found in all the nursing homes around the country.
Wow.
So when we look at some of the supplements that are really popular in the youth, sometimes I think, oh, do you know who needs them is the aging population.
Never heard of this before. This is why it's so interesting. Yeah, because of course when you mentioned whey and creatine, like, I would be supplementing on them. Well, creatine, I do it on and off. Whey every day.
Well, because you're a vegetarian and because the natural food sources of creatine are tend to be animal produce, you know, it's not such a bad thing for you to be supplementing with.
Mm-hmm.
But with whey, usually people, it depends how many muscle groups are working, but if it comes to after the gym, they usually need one scoop if they're little, but two scoops if they're in any way a bigger body.
Yeah. So with likes of protein, when they say, look, it does depend on your height and weight, like, that does make sense.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. So how much protein we need at a mealtime is usually our weight in kilos divided by 4.
Okay.
Unless you're older. So you need more protein if you're an older person than if you're a younger person. So, for example, if you're 80 kilos, you need around 20 grams of protein per meal.
OK, and then the last thing I'll say on protein, because I know it interests so many people, is that you see there's one shake in particular. I'm not going to mention the brand that I see. And they're like 50 grams of protein and it's in this one bottle. And from what I've learned, that's pointless. To an extent.
It is and it isn't. You see, the thing about nutrition is it's all about context.
Okay.
And this is why...
Well, most people are going to buy that bottle and they're going to just not go back.
Oh, yeah, totally. But you see, from a dietitian's point of view, you go, oh, well, because there's always context. So sometimes that's needed. So, for example, with athletes in their last meal of the day, we tend to lose muscle across the night.
Mm-hmm.
So the last meal of the day, research has suggested that if actually that's super high in protein, it can reduce the amount of muscle lost overnight. So with some of the athletes, I would be suggesting maybe, depending on their size, but 40 or 60 grams of protein than that.
Before bed?
So that'd
be a better time to eat it than, say, getting your 40 to 60 grams straight after your workout, which is what we're kind of told to do. You know, it's like, straight after your workout, you will lose all your gains if you don't take this scoop, you know?
No. So when the interesting thing about protein is once you get it every 3 to 5 hours, it's done what it can do to you.
Great. Okay.
So with protein, there's not a protein window. With carbohydrates, there is a carbohydrate window.
Okay.
So if athletes are listening or sports people, yes, you need to get the carbs in quite quickly after you train. But protein, you just need to make sure you're getting enough and regularly spread out.
Ah, okay. That's even changed my mindset a little bit, because the first thing I'd reach after a workout would be a protein rather than a carbohydrate.
Well,
now we're going back to eating more pasta. Yeah.
So with if you're burning carbs especially, or if you're looking for muscle gain, sometimes you need the carbohydrate, the shakes that have the carbohydrate and protein in them, in a ratio of around 3 to 1.
And usually they taste better as well. So,
So you're looking for 3 grams of carbs to around 1 gram of protein. So that sort of ratio after sports especially.
Great. Before we answer our final question, which is your 3 main takeaways for our listeners, we spoke so much about like everything that your body can digest pretty much in the last 45 minutes. If you had to pick one meal that's, you know, that gives you everything, what would it be? The most nutritious meal that you'd have?
Well, the most nutritious meal...
beans on toast? Would it be? Is that true what they say about beans on toast, that it gives you everything?
I think one of the meals that we eat in a balanced way is potatoes, meat and veg.
Okay.
So our potatoes, fish and veg. So if we look at the plate, around a quarter of the plate would be carbs, a quarter of it would be the meat or the fish or the meat alternative, and half the plate would be vegetables. And that's nutritionally balanced. When we eat something like chicken curry, the whole plate is rice and we dollop sauce on top.
Yeah.
Or if we eat spaghetti bolognese, the whole plate is pasta and some sauce is dolloped on top. So you don't get that ideal plate model where half of your meal is fruit and veg, a quarter is carbohydrate and a quarter is protein. So actually, which again the research says is the most commonly eaten meal in Ireland still, is a potato and meat and veg.
Yeah.
So I'm going to support our old school way of eating.
And then
because
for
it's wonderful.
Vegetarians and Vegans, we can say tofu instead.
Yeah, there's loads of protein options there. So tofu, soy chunks, which actually give the meat kind of texture people are kind of tapping into more vegetarian meals. Mm-hmm. Beans, peas and lentils.
Yeah.
There's loads of alternatives now, which is absolutely wonderful.
Great. So before I let you go then, your three main takeaways for our listeners, what would they be? I know we've touched on so much, but if you were to go, right, these are the three things that you really need to have bed into you, what would they be?
Follow qualified people on Instagram when it comes to nutrition.
Great. I'm a big fan of that. Not just because they look good or the paper matters. Like
we can look okay too.
Yeah. No.
So what I would encourage is following qualified people. So qualified nutritionists and dietitians for your nutritional information. I'd encourage people. The second thing would be to eat a varied diet. The more varied and inclusive your diet is, the more chance you're going to eat all the vitamins and minerals and nutrients that you require. Mm-hmm. So think less, more inclusive, less exclusive. And then the third thing would be look after your gut and eat the biggest variety of plants that you possibly can across the week.
Well, if you're listening right now and you've learned half as much as I've learned, well, then we're all on to a winner. Orla Walsh, that was absolutely fantastic. Where can people find you?
On Instagram, Orla Walsh Nutrition. On Facebook, Orla Walsh Nutrition. And on Twitter, Orla C. Walsh. But on my website, is simply Orla Walsh Nutrition. See, it's OWN, so it's Own Your Health.
Okay. Yeah,
I thought that was dead clever.
No, it is dead clever, absolutely, yeah.
Thank you. So, Orla Walsh Nutrition.
If you do one thing, you follow everything there and you go learn because it's so interesting. Orla Walsh, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the WellFest podcast with me, Marty Guilfoyle, brought to you by KBC. See you next time.